Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This case, when I first became involved in it, I thought it would probably be relatively simple because it was a two-day trial with a 300-page transcript. And once I got into it, I couldn't believe how many foul-ups there were regarding the chart, the charges, the jury instructions, and several other points of error that necessitated me and my professional judgment to brief 10 claims of error in this relatively short trial. There are a couple of overriding issues regarding examining or re-examining law dealing with cumulative error doctrine and also the time is not of the essence rule in child sex offenses. But before I delve into that, I want to briefly discuss argument six, which is our claim that the prosecutor repeatedly violated the Doyle rule regarding comments on post-arrest silence after Miranda warnings are given. I don't think there can be any dispute that there were Doyle violations here.
Were there any objections? Or are we looking at that under plain error?
You're looking at under plain error. The defense counsel only objected to the third one, which occurred during closing argument, the one during the cross-examination of the deputy, and then the one during the direct examination of the deputy and the cross-examination of the defendant were not objected to.
It looked like when we look at this court's prior precedents regarding that, State versus Brooks in particular, that in order to obtain a reversal, there at least it had to be some timely objections and so forth, that it's very hard to reverse on a Doyle violation under plain error because there may have been strategic reasons for the lawyer not making an objection.
I think the fact that he objected the third time would refute that there was a strategic reason. But
at that point, the trial's over, and he kind of knows more what the lay of the land is than.
Well, I would submit to you that I don't think there would be any reason to not object. If you look at the way the state argued the case in closing argument, the two main points they made as to why the jury should disbelieve the defendant and believe his daughter was the fact that he didn't volunteer this statement after he was arrested and this thing about the temperature, which was raised in point nine.
What about the fact that after he was Mirandized back at the station that he did make some exculpatory statements? How does that factor into the Doyle analysis?
I don't think it does because a similar general denial occurred in the Brooks case. And even in Doyle itself that I cited in the reply brief, the Doyle made some statements generally denying involvement, or like, I don't know what you're talking about, I didn't do it, something to that effect. And that's I don't think there's any way to say that's distinguishable. But I think the case that...
I may be missing something, but once he waived Miranda, how is Doyle still applicable? Because then his silence can't... I mean, he's waived his right to remain silent, so why is it improper to...
Well, there were three different violations. The first one, after giving Miranda at the farmhouse when he was originally arrested and taken down to the station, he invoked his Miranda rights. Then once he got down to the station, they Mirandized him again, and he says... My ex-wife put her up to it. And then the third time was in closing argument after the testimony of the defendant about some of the allegations. The prosecutor made, I thought, a very effective argument. Why didn't he tell the police this? And that's a classic Doyle violation.
But isn't it okay to do that once, if they're referring to the time after he waived his Miranda rights?
No. Only... Even the Anderson case and this court's prior decision in Antwine and even in Dexter, they say you waive your rights only to the substance of the statements you make.
But what about State versus Hutchison? Doesn't that also say you waive your rights to the fact of the silence as well?
Well, I think a lot of the cases, Hutchison included, involve distinct situations where the defendant gave a fairly detailed story of his version of events, and that's what happened in Anderson. And if there's a material inconsistency under the prior inconsistent statement rule, or if there's an omission or if they embellish it with more facts that they should have said, well, I didn't mention this, and then that's fair game for cross-examination. That's really more of a rule of the scope of cross-examination rather than Doyle itself, which was clearly designed to prevent silence from being used as evidence of guilt.
What did he say after he waived his right to remain silent? Did he then say anything beyond my what?
Okay. He said, it was basically what I think the court in Brooks would call a general denial.
My wife put her up to it. That's
right.
When he said that.
And, you know, I don't know what else, if you think about it, in this sort of allegation, what you could say. Because they didn't inform him anything about when, where, or what, how it happened. They just said, you're arrested for child molestation of your daughter. And so how would he say, well, I have an alibi for 3 weeks ago, or 2 weeks ago, whenever the last alleged incident occurred, which is before, as was charged. The case is real similar, I think most similar to the Dexter case and the Zindel case, where in Dexter, there were three separate Doyle violations, one during the cop's testimony, one during the cross-examination, and then again in closing argument. And I think the analysis of that, which was all under the plain error rule, there was no objection, was that if there are repeated violations, no curative actions, the defendant has a viable defense, then a new trial is warranted unless the evidence is overwhelming.
What about the point made by the Court of Appeals that he was acquitted of those matters as to which they inferred? I think wasn't that the one where they acquitted him, where they said, why didn't you say you were with these men at that time? And then they acquitted him of the charge that he was accused of
Two of the Doyle violations did involve that. The first one did not. It was mainly that he just refused to make a statement after he was Mirandized. But in any event, I think this
why would that not affect our determination of prejudice? There were the two more focused uses of that silence, the jury actually acquitted him.
I don't know why they, you could speculate as to why he was acquitted, but I think my key point here is this is a total credibility contest between the defendant and the victim. Or alleged victim. So anything that would detract from either witness's overall credibility, I think, is highly prejudicial. And if you look at the closing argument of the state, those were the two things that she basically argued that he's lying about everything because of this thing with the temperature, which is a separate point of error under point 9, coupled with the fact that he never told this exculpatory version until he testified.
You're running out of time, and I don't want you to lose track of your argument on time is of the essence. I realize the state has conceded that instruction number 8 was given in error. So is time of the essence still necessary to be argued?
Yes, because that deals with count 4. Counts 3 and 5 are the ones where there was a 6-year discrepancy between the charging document and the evidence and the jury instruction. And I don't think there's ever been a case where, as I pointed out in my reply brief, where there was this big of a foul-up. And I think what we really have here is a case of clear negligence by the prosecution and the trial court and the defense counsel, for that matter.
The concept grew up, didn't it, in the law in the context of if the evidence at trial went beyond the time set out in the indictment, whether that was okay, whether time was of the essence. Very few of the cases have applied it in the context of instructions then that submitted something that was in the indictment but as to which there was not evidence, and none have addressed whether or not that distinction is justified, that extension.
Right. The issue here, I think, is if you look at the prosecutor's closing argument at page 260, they argued to the jury that they had proven and that the victim testified that the act of digital penetration that formed the basis of counts 3 and 5 occurred when she was 13 years old. And that's what the jury instruction and the charging document said. There was no evidence put on to support that. The only testimony about any act of that nature occurred when she would have been 7, which is 6 years old.
May I ask a real practical question? If the jury instructions don't track the charging document, as an appellate court judge, how am I supposed to review the record for the determination of sufficiency of the evidence and double jeopardy?
That makes it difficult because, but that isn't the issue we really have here. We have the jury instruction and the information are consistent. They're just not supported by the evidence.
Well, that may go to the remedy involved in this case, I guess. I understand your argument is, you know, there's not sufficient evidence to support
right.
the verdict. But if the jury instruction, if the law allows the jury instruction not to track the charging document, how are we to determine, number one, whether or not the defendant was on notice of what he was charged with? Okay, but even if we get past that and there's a conviction, and then there's like this case, a split decision, you know, can this prosecutor now go back and pick new dates that may or not been covered, that may or may not have been believed, and recharge this person with some of these offenses again?
I think the imprecision creates that problem, and there's a big body of case law from this court and the lower courts. What you're talking about, I think, is what's normally called a variance, where there's a variance between the charging document and the instructions. And I think to show prejudice, or the cases that have granted new trials in those situations involve double jeopardy concerns. And this is why I think in this case the cleanest and only real remedy is to just wipe the slate clean and grant him a new trial on everything under the cumulative error doctrine and under the Doyle violation. But I want to point out that this is really not a case where the time of the essence should apply, because it's not a case where the victim became confused or was uncertain. It's a clear case of prosecution negligence. And Judge Harlan in the Link case talks about it. Criminal defendants, plaintiffs, defendants are all bound to bear the mistakes of their lawyers. Prosecutors should not be held to a different standard. If you look at count 10, which is one that he got acquitted on, there's a clear clerical error in the charging document and the jury instruction that set forth a two-day period in January of 2005, where there was no evidence at all presented that anything ever happened during that time. The jury acquitted him on that. It looked like there was a mistake, and somebody, the clerk or somebody, had penciled in a new date on the information, but that was the certified copy I got. But my point being, if he would have somehow got convicted of that, my opponent would be arguing, well, there's sufficient evidence to convict him because he did it earlier. So, I mean, we've got to draw a line on this somewhere, because this goes way beyond the parameters of what this rule was created for. And I think this is a clear case of attorney error that under a long body of common law case law, that whether you're a prosecutor or a defense attorney, plaintiff or a civil defense attorney, you foul up the case, you bear the consequences. There might be some other remedies that the client has, but it shouldn't be the defendant's fault when the lawyer for the state screws up a case as badly as this one. In my remaining minute or so, I just wanted to say that I think this also presents...
Well, you have a rebuttal. You have rebuttal time.
Okay.
Any other questions at this time? You have time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the court.
It does. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may touch briefly on the Doyle claim. At no point during this trial did the defendant ever object on the grounds that this was a Doyle violation, not even in closing argument. The objection in closing argument went to the nature of the evidence that had been offered by the defendant. There was no objection based on Doyle, nor was there a claim raised in the motion for new trial. The defendant comes before you now saying the trial court should have sua sponte declared a mistrial in this case, without ever any kind of request, which of course would be problematic in a case like this unless there were a manifest necessity to do so, as double jeopardy would then preclude
and
retrial.
And what if there had been an objection? Was this a violation? And your argument is that it's not prejudicial, or are you arguing it's not a violation?
I think that it was not a violation with regard to, let me begin by talking about the first one, which was at the farmhouse. when the officer said that he didn't sign the waiver at that point or waive his rights at that point. The record shows that he wasn't silent at that point. The officer just didn't have him fill out the waiver at that point. The record shows, though, that they had a conversation while they were at the farmhouse.
Was it beyond my wife must have put her up to it?
Because he was asking him, well, where do you have your condoms and things like that? And the defendant was answering those questions, and he directed them to where he had the condoms hidden up under the sink. So there was a discussion going on at the farmhouse. There just wasn't a signed waiver at that point. And that's all that the officer was referring to when he said that he didn't sign the, when he didn't waive at that point, said he didn't sign that waiver. And defense counsel brought out the same information on cross-examination. Now, he didn't sign the waiver at that point. That's right. And so the evidence, first of all, I don't think it was a Doyle violation because it wasn't a comment upon silence, nor was it a comment upon an invocation of his rights. There, at no point did he say, was there any evidence that he said?
Why was it relevant to say that at all?
You know, I think that was just, he was just sort of going through the historical facts of what occurred at the farmhouse. I'm not sure that it had very much relevance in terms of proving anything. It was just a recitation of the facts.
Was he under arrest at that time?
At that time.
At some point during that process, he was placed under arrest?
At some point during that process, he was placed under arrest. And my recollection is that he was under arrest at that time. Else, I think I probably would have made the argument that he was not in custody at that time. If I'm mistaken about that, I would just defer to the record. But then, of course, he's taken down to the police station. He's given the Miranda warnings again verbally. And this time he's asked about the allegations, and he denies them and says he didn't do it. And then he says, you know, my wife must have put her up to that, making an excuse for the allegations that the victim has made and trying to present a defense.
Is that the type of statement that would constitute a general denial?
I think that this goes beyond what you had in Brooks.
Okay, where what makes it go beyond?
Because the allegations themselves were referenced, and he made a statement about those specific allegations that the child must have been put up to it by his wife. Now, if you look at Brooks, I think that in Brooks, you know, the defendant was being questioned over a period of time, and his statements were more along the lines of, well, I'm lost, I don't know what to do, those kinds of things. And there was never, as I recall, a point where he gave an excuse.
What if he'd said here, she made it up?
What if the defendant had said here that she made it up?
Uh-huh.
I think that goes beyond a general denial as well, because he's offering a defense to the allegations. He's making...
I didn't do it? That's not a defense?
Well, I think that I didn't do it, if you're talking about a specific allegation, I have to think that is a statement that is not silence. And if the defendant...
What is this general denial that the Supreme Court says it's not a waiver, then if I didn't do it, it goes beyond that?
I think the general denial kind of statements are those that are sort of ambiguous, where he's like, what's going on here, or something like that, which is what you had, I think, in the Doyle case. What's going on? A sort of a statement that suggests the defendant is unaware of what's happening. And otherwise, I think that anybody can tell the police, no, I didn't do that, no, I didn't do that, no, I didn't do that.
I understand, but if they call it general denial and...
The Brooks case involved, I think it was a police officer.
Yes, it
right?
was.
So you think that was more of a general denial than what this was?
Well, in that case, I think it was more of a general denial, because I don't think he ever said, I didn't shoot her.
What's the reason for these distinctions? Can you help with policy reasons on trying to draw this line?
Well, personally, I think that Brooks was not silent. As you recall, I think I argued that case before the court. And in my view, there was a lot of talking going on in the Brooks case. Now, what the distinction might be there is that, you know, if somebody, frankly, I think the distinction should focus in on whether somebody has. And I think this is a little more clear in light of recent Supreme Court precedent. I think the distinction ought to be whether there's an unequivocal invocation of their right to silence. There's unequivocal silence, because that's the sort of silence that ought to be protected. When the Miranda warnings are given, I mean, the whole concept of Doyle is based on due process. When those Miranda warnings are given, there's a promise given to the defendant that if he remains silent, or if he says, I don't want to talk to you, or I want an attorney, we won't use that against you. Now, And it's that sort of protected silence that that it's unfair to then turn around and use against the defendant. But in other situations where the defendant makes some sorts of statements but doesn't provide any other explanation, I think it's fair to comment on the fact, well, he said this, and then if he comes up later, well, he didn't say that before. And, you know, the if you look at the and the reason why I say I think this might have been clarified a little bit recently by Supreme Court precedent is the Berghaus case, which is cited in my brief, where the defendant for a long period of time was questioned, and he was sort of looking down, and he was silent. He wasn't answering questions, and eventually he made a statement, and the state then used that against him, and they talked about the interrogation, and the United States Supreme Court said, you know what, he made a statement. And so there was no unequivocal invocation of his right to silence, and thus there wasn't a Miranda violation in introducing that evidence against the defendant. I think that although it's a different legal principle at play in Doyle, that an unequivocal invocation of the Miranda rights or the right to silence is what we should be protecting with Doyle. Otherwise, I think that that whatever the defendant says, in fact, the Miranda warnings themselves say, anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. If we then extend that to a sort of ambiguous silence where it might be a denial, it might not be a denial, I think that we start to get away from the underpinnings of the rule, which is the Miranda warnings implicitly promise, if you are silent, in fact silent, we won't use that against you. But if you say something else, we might.
Can you, switching gears,
sure.
Can you address the second issue in particular, why it's proper to put on evidence entirely unrelated to any charge and then submit an instruction entirely unrelated to any evidence?
Well, I think that I wouldn't say that the evidence in this case was entirely unrelated. I think that all of the evidence in this case of the long period of sexual abuse that this victim suffered at the hands of the defendant.
Absolutely, but that doesn't mean you get to submit things that aren't supported by the evidence, or you get to put on evidence of things that aren't charged. There were lots of things charged and lots of submissions, and the jury found some and didn't find others.
Well, forgive me, Your Honor. I take issue with one point there, which is that I think you can put on evidence of things that are not charged if they legitimately tend to prove the defendant's guilt. And in this case, I think they did because they went to show motive and the defendant's desire toward this particular victim, those sorts of things. Now, I understand.
I wasn't trying to address anything about other crimes or his feelings towards the defendant and so forth. I wasn't trying to address that at all. I'm concerned, and particularly with some of the double jeopardy implications we talked about, but that entirely different. I mean, there was a 6-year difference. This is not where someone got the date wrong or the location wrong, which was the other example. But this is, it's just an entirely different crime that perhaps should have been charged.
And let me address that. I apologize, Your Honor. I wasn't trying to go astray or avoid the question. But and it is a legitimate question in this case, because the victim's most explicit testimony about digital penetration was concerned when she was 7 years old. That's on page 37 of the transcript, and she's pretty clear when she says that happened then. The rest of her testimony is, concerns. Well, I shouldn't say the rest of it, but
there was no attempted amendment at that time.
No, there was not, and I think the reason why was simply this: that, you know, the victim offered a lot of testimony about long time periods and about lots of different acts that occurred during those time periods. And I think the prosecution was proceeding on the notion that she had said that he had done sexual intercourse, anal intercourse, oral intercourse, touching basically everything during these various time periods. And so, for whatever reason, they chose the time period when she was 13, which was the time period that she specifically identified as the time when he started having sexual intercourse with her, to charge four of these particular acts. Now,
didn't testify to any facts to support it, what justifies them submitting on it? I perfectly understand deciding to charge on that, and I assume they thought they would get evidence on that, but then what happens when you don't?
Well, and I guess that, you know, I didn't go beyond addressing the time of the essence argument. I guess it raises a question which I won't talk about here because you're more interested in the other thing, but whether her general testimony would support a finding also that it happened during the during the submitted time period when she was 13. But going back to your question, the way that this claim was raised, I think, dictates how it should come out. It was raised as a claim of sufficiency of the evidence. And what was charged here was conduct. And yes, there was a time period identified. But when we're talking about the offense itself, the elements of the offense, what matters is whether there was digital penetration of the victim.
So what do we apply double jeopardy to?
Well, that raises a separate issue. Could we then go back, as Judge Fischer was asking, if in the next go around, could we look at the information in this case and know what was precluded? Perhaps not. Perhaps in the next case down the road, we would have to resort to a look at the transcript.
Are we going to get into a situation where the states are arguing, well, double jeopardy doesn't apply to this one because it isn't in the information, and then in the next case, double jeopardy doesn't apply to this one because it wasn't in the jury instruction? And then finally it'll be, well, that wasn't it. Nobody testified to that, so we surely didn't charge that or try that. I mean, at some point in time, as a reviewing court, we have to be able to say, okay, this is what they charged, this is what they tried to prove, they either did it or they didn't do it. And really, the last chance is to get the instructions right. I mean, at that point, all the lawyers can either object to amending the pleadings, object to expanding the time, but that's the last time before it gets to the jury where the lawyers and the trial judge can tell us at least what they think they tried.
Agreed, Your Honor. And of course, there was no objection to the instructions.
Well, if you like the instructions, you don't object to them because you think you know the case you tried.
That's true.
The problem you get into is, in this case, maybe the lawyers each thought they tried a different case.
It's possible.
So how do we sort that out? If we can't rely on the pleadings or the evidence or the instructions, how are we supposed to sort it out?
Well, I think you can rely on the pleadings. I think you can rely on the evidence. And here, there really wasn't expressed testimony from this victim of any other digital penetration except for the one she identified when she was 7 years old. I would think that if this court upheld the conviction that was entered based on that alleged conduct, that the state could never go back and charge that
again.
But
that's not what the jury found. The jury found this conduct because that's how it was chosen to be submitted, occurred at a time when it's very clear from the record there was nothing said about that.
True, but what we're talking about is sufficiency of the evidence, and the date that this offense occurred is not an element of the crime.
But now, it's what the jury found, and it was not supported. It was submitted for him to find. I understand.
And the jury sometimes is instructed to find matters that are mere surplusage in a case. And where surplusage is found by the jury, but it doesn't affect the sufficiency of the case, the defendant shouldn't be discharged on that. Now, I agree completely that this raises other problems. And down the road, if we try to convict him again for the time when she was seven for this particular conduct, I think the state would not prevail, not in any circumstance. Now, it does complicate the matters because we can't just look at the pleadings. But, you know, I don't think that in determining double jeopardy that we're limited to the pleadings. That's just one purpose that the pleadings sometimes have in cases, is to tell us. But that wouldn't limit a subsequent court's review of whether double jeopardy occurred in the next case.
But how would you, I mean, the jury can... If they charged him with the crime that occurred under the evidence, that's not the crime he was convicted of. So you could charge him again with the same evidence?
Well, at this point, I guess what I'm looking forward to is there are two routes that the court could follow at this point. One would be to affirm this conviction because, in fact, there was evidence that he digitally penetrated the victim's vagina while she was, you know, a young child, and as required by the statute. And at that point, because the time period identified by the victim's testimony precludes or covered the time while she was seven, the state could never charge that conduct again during that time period. If the court were to conclude, on the other hand, and I see my time is up, if I may finish.
Right.
If the court were to conclude otherwise, that the evidence was insufficient as it was submitted to the jury in this case because it included the date range where there was no evidence, I guess the question that would arise in my mind is, well, can we then, can we charge the correct date period based on what we know?
Isn't that what, isn't that what is suggested in the Solis Garcia case?
Perhaps, and that may be the.
I mean, because we have to rely on, we have to be able to rely on something to review these cases.
I agree, and in that regard, I think that what the defendant has identified here is not so much a question of sufficiency, in as much as the date is not an element, but a problem with the instruction as drafted, and thus it appears more along the lines of an instructional error as opposed to a sufficiency error. And that's important because a finding of insufficient evidence results in a discharge.
Of course, time does matter if you have an alibi.
It does. Like it's a general rule that it's not of the essence. And of course, if there's an alibi.
And you acknowledge that all this arose in the context of indictments that said between January and May, and then the evidence was July, and the court said you're dealing with witness testimony, which is inexact. Time is not of the essence. That's not one of the elements of the crime. I'm aware, I think it's two cases without discussion applied it to instructions, without any discussion of whether that rationale would mean you could submit something that was not supported in the evidence.
Well, and in that regard, I've cited several cases in my brief. A lot of them do deal with variances.
Right.
One deals with sufficiency of the evidence, which is the Canifax case, dealing with sufficiency of the evidence on counts 3 and 4, it's point 3 in the brief, and the opinion talks about how there was a lot of evidence of many acts, both before the submitted time period, and I think there was some also during the time period, but the victim, the testimony was not specific, and in that instance the court also cited the time is not of the essence in terms of in stating that the dates were not an element of the offense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the all of the cases dealing with this time is not of the essence rule, Sexton, Canifax, and Carney were the three that involved sufficiency of the evidence. In all those cases, there wasn't any doubt that the acts could have occurred in the time period in the indictment and then jury instruction. It was just expanded a little bit. To expand where, and it could have happened during or after. It doesn't involve a case like here where it is crystal clear that the act he was convicted of did not occur when they charged him and instructed the jury. And I think you need to look to the Cole versus Arkansas case, which the old Supreme Court case where they said that to comport with due process, you've got a conviction must lie on consideration of what the evidence was.
Was there any indication here the jury was confused by these discrepancy in dates?
There's no way to know.
No notes sent out or no?
Well, I know there's one thing I wanted to point out. It has to do with the Doyle claim, was they asked for the defendant's statement to the police, which I think certainly exacerbates or undercuts their argument that they weren't thinking about that and thinking about what he told them.
But back to these dates, it's not like January 1 to January 1. I mean, it's December 3rd to December 3rd. It's kind of a unique date that's used in both instances, just the year is the discrepancy.
With the exception of that 10th count, which was the most screwed up of all, it looks like what they did was they just tracked it from birth date to birth date, and the conviction under counts 3 and 5, they argued that it occurred while she was 13, which would have been between December 3rd of 2004 and December 3rd of 2005, when her testimony was it occurred 6 years earlier.
What happens if you have a date range like that in a case where admittedly the law is that time of the essence doesn't apply? And the state puts on evidence of child molestation in the bedroom, child molestation in the barn, and the information doesn't say where, and the instructions don't say where, and they're found guilty of one count. Which one did they find them guilty of?
Well, I think you addressed the situation. That's that Celis Garcia case, I think. You reversed her conviction, I believe, under the state constitutional right to a jury trial. But I think that's really the point. I think a competent lawyer in this case would have filed for a bill of particulars to try to get more particulars about what the time, try to narrow the range if possible, and also specify which sex acts occurred when, and when, where, and how. That wasn't done here, and it's like I said, I think all the parties to this lawsuit have a lot of blame, mainly the prosecutor for not presenting their case very effectively, but I think the trial judge and the defense counsel were asleep at the switch on a lot of this stuff, too, or it would have never happened.
I think I understand your argument about the cases, that the Supreme Court, are you saying the Supreme Court cases are very limited in their application of the concept, time is not of the essence, that those were slight variances in the time, and that the Court of Appeals has applied that across the board anytime there's any question about time and in very egregious circumstances?
Well, nothing as egregious as this. In fact, the only time in modern times this court has addressed it was in dicta in the Celis-Garcia case. They cited a couple of 50-100-year-old cases where it came up under the old statutory rape laws from the early 20th century. But these have all been intermediate court of appeals decisions. And I think it's just snowballed that any time you have any sort of claim of error regarding a bill of particulars or a variance or a sufficiency of the evidence, which is what we have here, that's just sort of the rubber stamp to response to say, well, time is not of the essence, we're affirming your conviction. But this goes way beyond anything that any court from this state has ever seen.
Any other questions?
Thank you. I'd ask that the court reverse his convictions.
Thank you. Appreciate that.